Welcome back to the program. As Republicans now face the reality of trying to run Congress with a rather diverse group of freshman legislators, so too, 2 years ago, the Obama administration came to office with real divisions within their coalition. Divisions between true believers, what our guest this morning, Richard Wolff, calls revivalists, and those with a more practical Washington-based agenda, the so-called survivalists. Amidst these divisions, the country faced problems unequaled since the 1930s, an opposition party set to no as its default position on everything, and still the new president accomplished an extraordinary amount. How did this play out? What price did the administration and the country pay? That's the backdrop for our guest Richard Wolff's new book, Revival. Richard Wolff is an award-winning journalist, a political analyst for MSNBC, a former White House correspondent for Newsweek. It is my pleasure to have Richard Wolff here to talk about his book, Revival. Richard Wolff, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. One of the things that we always see when new presidents come in, and it's true in anything in politics, is that there's always this disconnect between campaigning and governing. That disconnect seemed larger in this case. Why is that?
Well, it was larger because the campaign was larger, for a start. It didn't just run for a very long time, for 21 months, which I covered all the way through, but it also was bigger because it wasn't a means to an end. This is where these people got their sense of identity and forged that identity together. So the principles, the way they did their business and conducted themselves, these were important measures of who they were, and moving that into the White House was much more difficult, not just because of the crises they faced, but because of what the campaign represented and what it took to be a part of it and to create it. So, that was one big piece of it. You know, the president has often talked about the world as it is and the world as it should be. It's a phrase that comes from his community organizing days. And reconciling idealism, the idealism of the campaign, with the realism, the world as it is, of governing, has been extraordinarily difficult and is to this day when we're about to launch into another campaign.
One of the things that made it more difficult, that certainly comes across in Revival, is that this disconnect, this ambivalence about which way to turn, goes to the very heart of Obama himself.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that this debate is unresolved. And it's been shocking to many of his most loyal aides. When they were finishing up the campaign, I recount in Revival this debate argument they had with the guy heading up the transition, John Podesta, the former Clinton chief of staff, who said, well, I know you've made all these promises about not having lobbyists in the administration, but there are all these great people that we want to hire, and we can't do that. They actually had to have a conversation with him when they said, well, that's tough. You know, it's okay. We don't need those people. And merging the two things together, this Washington mentality with their campaign spirit, was difficult from the get-go. Of course, some lobbyists actually made it into the administration. Many of them are still frustrated they have been locked out. But that gives you a sense of the complexity. And a lot of it does come back to a president who said to himself, well, I want to do big things, and I better know how Washington works, so I've got to make some compromises along the way. Unfortunately, those compromises served to undermine what he stood for and what he spoke about for so long in the 2008 campaign.
Was the problem that the people on both sides of this debate, the survivalists and the revivalists, were both so locked into their positions from the get-go that there wasn't anybody other than perhaps the president himself who really had one foot in both camps, who could try and navigate this and solve some of these problems?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think it's also fair to say that there were some big characters on both sides who made it difficult to find compromise. People like Rahm Emanuel, who was the sort of chief advocate of the survivalist position of just putting points on the board and doing deals and playing small ball, and especially on something like health care. You know, when you have big characters, it does take a president to resolve that kind of dispute, and it's been extraordinarily difficult for him. I think that's one of the big things they're grappling with right now. When they approach Republicans at this stage, is it to get a deal done, or is it to frame up the next round of campaigning? Those are two very different objectives.
And certainly part of it, as you write about, is that they didn't anticipate the degree to which no would be absolutely the default position for any Republicans.
And that's true. They didn't understand how disciplined they would be until it was too late. They thought that they would just join with them in governing the country at a time of crisis. But as Rahm Emanuel himself told me in Revival, this is a GOP that is not your father's Republican Party. There's no Bob Dole to work with. Even Ronald Reagan from California would have extreme difficulty getting the presidential nomination because of his positions on social issues, because he raised taxes in California. So the Republican Party has changed, and that change was really confirmed by these most recent elections. So, you know, that sort of has to be factored into their miscalculations here. It took them time to understand just how big a shift that was.
The part that is so frustrating to watch in this is how effective they were during the campaign in creating a narrative and communicating the narrative of the campaign to the American people, and what an abject failure they have been in putting forth a governing narrative.
Yeah, and I think that's something they've been discussing for a year or more, certainly at the start of the year when they lost the Massachusetts Senate race. President, even the First Lady, has been deeply frustrated by this. And, you know, after you discuss things for a year or more, you've got to realize that there's something chronic going on here. It's not a lack of talent. It's not like there are stupid people who are doing this stuff. And that's why I say communications is really a symptom, not a cause of their problems. And the cause is this identity question. What kind of politician are you trying to be here? Are you trying to be the inside Washington guy or the outside Washington guy? As a campaigner, it was very clear that it was the outside Washington game that he was playing, and I think it's the mixed message that's the problem. If you are going to say, the Recovery Act is going to be a job cutter, a job saver, and a job creator, it's going to cut taxes and invest in infrastructure, you're trying to be everything to everyone, and in the end, you end up as being not much to anyone.
You talked earlier about how long the campaign lasted, roughly 20, 21 months of the campaign. Given how long it lasted, given that the campaign was so much a part of who these people were, you get the sense that there was almost a relief that the campaign was over, that they wanted to go into governing mode while the Republicans stayed absolutely in campaign mode.
I think that's right. And I think they also wanted to put the president on a pedestal at a time when maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. The pedestal would have been there anyway. But yes, there's burnout's real. There's a certain amount of enjoying the prestige of the presidency when you've been living sort of a rough existence, traveling around the country for 2 years. But that burnout is real and doesn't sort of stop. It's not like the pace of the White House is eased, especially when the other side is campaigning so hard. And you know, one thing they did very effectively in the campaign was to push back on some of the myths, the outrageous lies that the other side pushed out there, or that just sprung up from the Internet. I think in the White House their feeling was, we don't need to deal with that stuff. It's kind of demeaning or it's off topic. And in fact, you still have to rebut the lies and distortions, especially when it comes down to basic things like whether the president's American or not, or right, whether he's Christian or not.
To what extent were so many, particularly the survivalists, people like Rahm Emanuel and other more experienced Washington hands, to what extent were they playing by a set of rules from other administrations and other presidents?
That's a great point. You know, I do think there is a constant temptation to project the sort of Clinton template on this president, as if everything follows the previous path and the world has not changed, or even that the characters are the same. I'm amused by people saying, well, it's now time for the president to triangulate because that's what Clinton did. But this is a president who always came in saying he was going to unite red and blue America. So, you know, their issue has been losing the independent voters who they had in 2008 who turned against them. That's not the same situation that Clinton came in. He didn't have the same coalition or the same appeal to begin with in 92 that Obama had in 2008. So they start off in different places. They are different characters. It's a different time, a different media environment, different technology, and different politics. So, yeah, they overlearned the lessons of healthcare. They thought that if they did deals with special interests on healthcare, that, you know, there wouldn't be money spent against them. But turned out that money could funnel through the Chamber of Commerce anyway, and that people who agreed with them on one side were secretly funneling money against them on the other. It's just not the same world.
You also mentioned, you know, Rahm Emanuel's tendency to want to play small ball. This was, again, another carryover from the Clinton administration.
Exactly. And, you know, Obama, to his credit, keeps saying, I don't want to do small stuff and be a two-termer. I'd much rather be a one-termer and do big stuff. Now, personally, I think he's very competitive to the point that he wants to do big stuff and be a two-termer. It's not an either-or for him. But that was very much, him going around saying that, is very much a rebuke to the Clinton folks and to that model of the presidency. And survival isn't enough for him, even as he was pursuing the tactics of survival. I think it's really important to remember that at heart he's still an idealist. He still thinks about the world as it should be, not just the world as it is.
Of course, like any administration, you write about they were the internal struggles that went on, particularly among the economic team.
Yeah, very dysfunctional group of people. Larry Summers, right at the heart of it, told the president going in that he wasn't a good manager. Well, that certainly proved to be the case. He promised that he'd run an honest policy process, but frankly, talking to the people around him and above him, they didn't feel that was the case. And that made a difficult economy that much harder to deal with, because not only were there intractable policy disputes, but even the president was frustrated that he couldn't break on initiatives for small businesses, on the Volcker Rule dealing with Wall Street, trying to limit its power there to deal on its own behalf. You know, Summers was a key player in making a difficult situation that much more complicated. But to be fair, it wasn't just him. They were all behaving in a childish and petty way, turf battles, personality clashes. That's one reason why that economics team has been pretty much overhauled, and we're waiting to see what the new economic team will look like.
Another aspect is that the whole debate about health care and the whole way that that played out through the legislative process, it was taking on something that brought these issues, this revival versus survival mode, it brought those problems into bold relief in ways that might not have happened as quickly if they had taken on smaller projects.
That's true. That is absolutely true. You know, being ambitious does sort of push this thing to a crisis. To those people like Rahm Emanuel who said, you know, maybe this wasn't the time to do big stuff like healthcare. Maybe there was another time. I don't know, looking at the political environment now, you could say that, because it was always going to be a difficult cycle for Democrats. They were always going to lose seats, maybe not as much, but it's hard to pin that down just on health care. I will just say this, though. This president has been written off so many times before. He's been left for dead. Health care was left for dead at the time when I embedded myself inside the White House. He keeps bouncing back. How he does that, how he revives himself, is a real lesson for people who support him and for people who disagree with him. But, you know, it happened time and again through the campaign. It's happened time and again through this president. We're at that point right now. People who think it's over need to look at the track record and see how many times they've said that before and how many times he's proved them wrong.
Well, people said that about George Bush getting reelected in 2004.
They did. They did. Things were rough for him then. Iraq had spiraled out of control, and the economy was very sluggish. You know, you cannot underestimate the power of campaigning when you're an incumbent president, but also the kind of resilience it takes to get through these things and how that itself steals them for the next battle when it comes to politics. You know, it helps when you know who the opponent is, and Bush was lucky that the Kerry campaign was so disorganized. You know, if it's Sarah Palin on the other side, then I think a lot of those pundits who are so confident about 2012 may need to rethink and may need to have their quotes thrown at them again, by the way.
One of the unique things about the Obama campaign was the tremendous grassroots aspect of it. Talk a little bit about how you think this grassroots aspect played out in the transition to governing. Was it a help or was it a hindrance? Or could it have been used differently once they were in the White House?
Well, I think it could and should have been used differently had they not decided that they were campaigning or governing. You know, a lot of the revivalists said, why was it a choice? Why did you have to say we're not going to do the campaigning stuff anymore? And while there's still a lot of online support for him, I don't believe things are lost by any means in terms of reviving the online grassroots support for this president. But it was a real missed opportunity in my view. There was no real ask of the very active, direct action approach of the grassroots, other than to call members of Congress? Well, you know, if you've gone out there knocking on doors, if you've really gone that extra mile, you've given money, you've thrown yourself all in, calling a member of Congress is not really what you signed up for. That's very much a traditional Washington political approach. I think they could have got people to volunteer in schools, clean up neighborhoods, maybe clean up the Gulf, pick up oil, or get involved in environmental cleanup elsewhere. You know, there was not that kind of imaginative approach, a fresh approach to politics and to Washington, because I think this mentality was, we're now governing, we can leave all that behind. That was a big mistake, a missed opportunity.
There was also a lot of fear, a sense of fear of the revivalist, of the grassroots. The scene you talk about with respect to health care and Chuck Grassley is kind of a personification of that fear.
There was a fear in how to approach this. You know, the idea of winning independent voters somehow got reduced to the idea of winning a couple of Republican votes. And so looking reasonable, taking on, frankly, Republican ideas, most of the health care approach has really been supported actively by Republicans before, whether it's Mitt Romney or Chuck Grassley himself. And I recount this scene in Revival where the president goes to Grassley and says, in the Oval Office, if I give you 100% of what you want, as opposed to 95%, which is what it is already, if I give you 100% of what you want, will you agree to this? Will you vote for this? And Grassley says, no, I cannot do that. I won't be the only Republican out there. You've got to get 9 or 10 other people like me before I'll do that. So the politics was never going to work for them. You know, what was the measure of what they were trying to do? What was the goal here? Was it just the legislation? Or was it actually saying to a broader public, we're actually not socialists. This isn't the scary big government plan. You know, one of the ways they revived healthcare was by picking up a campaign ad and almost parroting it word for word in a speech in the White House, where the president said, there are people on the left of me who want the sort of Canadian-style system. There are people on the right who want to leave you to the hands and the mercy of your insurers. My plan is in the middle. And that's what worked in 2008. It worked in closing out health care, and it's got to work again if they want to revive their own fortunes for 2012.
Why has neither side, the survivalists or the revivalists, been effective in portraying at all how much the administration and the president have actually accomplished in the past 2 years?
You know, it's interesting. I hear from progressives who believe that the president hasn't done anything on the jobs situation or the economy. That's as if $800 billion on the Recovery Act was never spent. There was an assumption inside the White House that the politics would take care of itself, that good policy would speak for itself. Well, that was a very idealistic way of thinking. I mean, you have to go out and talk about this stuff until you're sick of it, because people don't hear it otherwise. And that was true of Bush in 2004 on a very different agenda, a different kind of politics. It's true of this White House now. If you don't talk about this stuff, then the other side will. And the assumption has been that everything to do with the economy has failed. Look at GM now. I know people didn't like the car bailout and the automakers. That situation was very unpopular even inside the White House, but it worked. It worked. Millions of people have jobs in the Midwest now because of the bailout of the car industry. GM just had just about the most successful IPO in American history just a couple of weeks ago. They need to go out and tell that story. It's not obvious.
Is there a value, could there have been a greater value in this inherent tension that we have been talking about, that you write about in Revival, between the practical Washington hands and the idealists? Could that have been turned into a positive force within the administration, both in terms of governing and communicating?
Oh, if the two sides had got on better, yeah, sure. I mean, the campaigning folks know how to sell a message and tell their story. The problem, the conflict was, if you just take something like healthcare or economic policy, if you're deferring the policy decisions, if you're leaving them in the hands of congressional folks, or if your economic team cannot agree, then it's hard to sell a message. It's hard to communicate with people, because if you start talking about what healthcare does for people, if you start talking about your approach to small businesses, when the policy debate isn't fixed, you're kind of closing doors. If you start saying, we're going to help insure more people, well, does that mean you want healthcare to go in that direction? If you're going to say, we're going to lower costs, if that's the most important message you've got, well, does that mean healthcare goes in that direction? So there was a sensitivity there to the governing side of things, which meant that campaigning was put on hold. And could they have resolved that? Yes, but they would have had to have left all of those unresolved decisions in a much shorter time frame. They needed to close the circle on some of these debates much quicker to get into that marketing, selling, communicating, campaigning mode.
Have both sides come away with the experience of this last election with totally different lessons?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely. Both sides, both parties, for sure. You know, the Republicans think it was all about big government and the fired-up nature of their own base. The White House thinks it's about their communications problems and about independent voters. I tend to agree with the White House that really the key movement here wasn't the Tea Party, wasn't the right of the Republican Party. It was the independent voters, many of whom lean conservative, by the way. So there's some overlap there, but that's the big switch in this election between 2008 and now. You do not win back independent voters, and you do not hold on to them if you're a Republican, by pandering to your base. You just don't do that. Independent voters, by nature, do not like the partisan warfare. They do not like people beating each other up. They want to see Washington work with both sides. And that's why it's important for this president to reach out the hand, to look reasonable. If the other side slaps it away, then you go out and tell independent voters, we tried, they said no. But if the next 2 years of both sides saying the other side said no, you're going to get a lot of people who will be very disillusioned in 2012. That's true on the left and the right.
But within the
both will not be happy.
But within the White House, have the survivalists and the revivalists come away with different lessons from this election?
I think the revivalists are in the ascendancy here. You know, this president is under no illusions now. The campaign has begun. People like David Plouffe, the campaign manager, who's so successful in 2008, is coming back into the White House. He wasn't there for the last 2 years. And his return to the Obama inner circle, it has been accelerated. It's coming quicker than we thought at the start of the new year rather than later in the spring. And so I think there's much more of a campaign spirit now. A lot of people are saying on the left, well, he's looking like he's going to compromise on all sorts of things. Let's see how this plays out. I don't say that he's not going to compromise on tax cuts, because clearly the pressure is on for him to do so, but you can still have a serious and combative discussion about deficits, about long-term tax cuts and tax policy, because if the other side is saying we want to deal with the deficits, but they take tax cuts off the table, they take all taxes off the table, then you know, that's not a serious debate, and that's where the campaigning comes back into this. That's where the revivalist spirit is. You know, you've got to take risks. That's what they learned in 2008. You've got to be a rule breaker, not just someone who is cautious. Seeing them rebalance that is going to be the key challenge over the next year.
Of course, what we see in terms of the media, or at least on cable television, is more the extremes of both sides, the voices of the extreme right or the extreme left.
Yeah, and people in the White House spoke very frankly about how difficult this is making it to govern at this time. The media environment, not because they blame the media so much as you have members of Congress who now measure their performance, not in terms of legislation or the debate about policy, but in terms of whether they get on cable TV. And I'm a guy on cable TV all the time. I love cable, but I don't think that members of Congress need to make that their objective. I think that's very unhealthy, and this cable internet culture has come to dominate the discussion on Capitol Hill. It's not a good development.
Is the foreign policy team working better, and is it allowing them to be focused more on governing in ways the economic and domestic issues haven't allowed them to do?
Well, in spite of the various crises you see, like North Korea and maybe the WikiLeaks stuff, the foreign policy team has worked surprisingly well together, and that's in spite of the sort of lingering tensions and rivalry between the Clinton folks and the Obama folks. They have fulfilled the most important foreign policy promise this president made from the beginning, which was to end combat operations in Iraq. He doesn't get a lot of credit for it, but that's a real promise they kept. You know, in the period I was there, they dealt with the Haiti earthquake surprisingly swiftly and effectively. Even though everyone said it was his Hurricane Katrina, that wasn't the case, in spite of the overwhelming humanitarian misery and challenges in Haiti. And the diplomacy now, as hard as it is on so much of a better track than it was in the Bush years. So I'm kind of surprised that a lot of people say this is a disaster and nothing has changed. This is a very difficult time in terms of terrorism threats, in terms of the Middle East and Iran's nuclear program. You cannot underestimate those challenges, but you also shouldn't overlook just how much things have changed and moved on in the last 2 years.
And finally, given the nature of the Republicans that have been elected to Congress in this last election, do the Republicans face a similar problem now between revivalist and survivalist within their own party, and what price will they pay for that?
Well, they do. Just immediately, they've got to raise the national debt ceiling, because otherwise the United States is going to default on its debt. That's going to be extremely difficult for many Tea Party folks who think that they will always vote no on everything and won't certainly have anything to do with something that increases the deficit. But, you know, Republicans have to govern too now. If they put the United States in default, then the financial crisis of 2008 will look like, well, a Tea Party, actually.
Richard Wolff, the book is Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House. Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.